Thank you, General Meese. I'm always grateful for complimentary introductions. At a recent graduation, I heard a valedictorian say to the crowd, distinguished faculty. Well, welcome to this final course in the intellectual repast of the last 2 days, or as a college date of mine at dinner once said, the peace of resistance. Lest you think that was simply American cultural narrowness, the following year I was in England and I took this cute English girl out to an Italian restaurant, and when the maitre d' greeted us and said, ciao, she flashed a smile and said, yes. I know how to pick them. a more serious note, sort of black humor in a way, perhaps you saw this morning's news where Christy Whitman formally announced that she supported President Clinton's veto of the partial birth abortion bill, claiming that it occurs extremely rarely and only in instances where women's lives are truly at stake. She's co-chair of the Dole committee, and I wonder if Don Devine could show her where the door in that airplane is. Sometime before Labor Day. In the last day, we have heard from many witnesses about the Supreme Court's tendency to exceed, in Nino Graglia's view, or to understate, in Roger Pallone's view, its role in the constitutional scheme of things. What has been less apparent has been how the Supreme Court has changed the very structure of the Constitution, not only regarding its role, but the roles of the other two branches, and of course the states. We know from the Constitution that a college of electors elects the president, at least formally. We also know from the Constitution that the states originally, and then later the people of the several states, are the electors of the United States Senate. We also know, although many do not notice this in Article 1, that the electors of the House of Representatives of the United States Congress are those who can legitimately vote for the most numerous branch of the state legislature in each respective state. But did you know that we now have changed the structure of the Constitution where we have electors of the United States Supreme Court? They are the President and the Senate. Just as we elect electors who in turn elect the President, we now elect the President who promises to elect Supreme Court justices whose policies will be in accord with what he or we want. The Supreme Court is now a freestanding branch of government that can initiate thorough changes in our social policy, and the President and Congress have accepted that role. The President now elects a Supreme Court justice, not appoints him, as even conservatives say, if he just does the job right, who will vote the right way. And the Senate, in its confirmation hearing, lists the policies it wants the Supreme Court justice to support. Are you in favor of capital punishment? Do you support a woman's right to an abortion? Do you think we should have prayer in public schools? Should homosexuals be protected? What about property rights? Do you support affirmative action? So the Constitution today has been changed not only in its division of powers, but the other branches have accepted the new division and have relegated themselves in at least partial measure to the role of electors. They no longer resist the Supreme Court's excesses. They accept its legitimacy as the ultimate policy-making branch and seek only to have an influence in what the Supreme Court may decide. And that is why what General Meese said at the beginning, that the 1996 election is not only important as to what the Supreme Court will decide, but what kind of justices will re-amend the constitutional role of the Supreme Court and the roles of the President and Congress concomitantly in relation to what the founders intended. That watershed change has been noted before in this conference, and it came to fruition in 1938. Now, back in the 1970s, when I was a young college instructor, fresh out of graduate school, I came to a campus recently riled by the revolts stemming from the Cambodian incursion. Many of you lived through that difficult time. At one faculty meeting, where we were considering dropping the foreign language requirement for graduation, I first met the cowardice of the academy. I rose and quietly and tremulously, for it was my first speech, gave a defense of the requirement. And I said, how can anyone truly progress in one's pursuit of a liberal education without knowing the vocabulary of another nation's literature? The speech got some applause, surprisingly, and then some professor on the other side said, well, aren't universities getting away from such requirements, and isn't that progress? And one of my allies piped up, and it says, it all depends which way you're pointed. For the law to return to the Supreme Court, the justices have to start pointing in the right direction. There are now really two constitutions vying for supremacy in the Supreme Court chambers. For Justice Souter and the liberals, the founding of our constitutional structure occurred in 1938. For Justice Thomas, and occasionally for some of the other conservative justices, 1787 marks the date of the founding. The questions before the new administration should be, before one is elected, is whether the judges will progress to the earlier date. The future of true law lies in the past, not in replicating the actual society of some mythical age, but in adhering to first principles, the principles the founders consciously based our Constitution upon. In 1938, or by 1938, the Supreme Court totally revolutionized the basis of its authority and the authority of every branch of government. Every branch of government. It declared that there were no higher principles that defined the structure of the Constitution. It declared that the purpose for which the government was given, that the purpose of government was power, and that the purpose of democracy was to keep power balanced between vying constituencies, each seeking to have its own part of the pie. In fact, the Supreme Court's role would subsequently be in this structure solely an arbitrator, making sure that every constituency had a piece of the political pie so that the fight for power could be carried on. The Supreme Court embraced positivism and made it the basis of our whole constitutional scheme of right and of power, from the president down through the states. Positivism became purely and simply the legitimate basis of our laws. True, the Supreme Court made this statement in the language of judicial restraint. It said that the will of the people was the grounding of all legitimate laws. And the Supreme Court itself was an uneasy interloper in the face of that positivistic will, and a job henceforth would only to make sure that the political process was open enough to accommodate the wills. But once it established the will as a legitimate basis of government, how could it deny itself the right to legislate once it recognized that it too could make laws solely on the basis of will? Recently, for example, when Judge Reinhardt of the Ninth Circuit held that there was a constitutional right to be killed by a hired physician, he justified his argument primarily by saying, well, the Supreme Court has found other rights that were not in the original Constitution. Why shouldn't we? It's exactly what he said. Remember that in Roe v. Wade, the only legitimacy Justice Blackmun asserted for the creation of that new right was that, in his words, the members of the court feel it is a liberty of the 14th Amendment. That was the extent of his logical justification. The 1938 justices and their progeny have forgotten the difference between authority and power. Authority induces the moral obligation to obey. Authority limits the exercise of power to only those who have the legitimate right to exercise it. Power is authority's opposite. Power coerces conformity without any call on the people's moral obligation to obey. No wonder Justice Souter was so frightened of the Lopez decision, mild as it was. The court in Lopez was actually insisting that there was an authoritative limit to its power, and that authority was the Constitution. For Justice Souter, the only limit to the court's power is the recognition of its power by the other political branches. It is power against power, not authority harmonizing the scheme into a complementary whole. You have to remember that in Madison's view, checks and balances was not merely a device to frustrate power, but to induce a cooperation among groups whose interests might otherwise be at odds. Yet in Lopez, Justice Souter claimed he was upholding judicial restraint by deferring to the power of Congress, while Justice Rehnquist and Justice Thomas spoke about the authority and the limits to the authority of Congress. Justice Souter's position is not a genuinely conservative position. It is a species of status conservatism, practiced by anyone from the businessman with a government contract to the liberal professor with tenure, who fears to give up his position of power. Souter fears to give up his position of power to the principle of authority of the Constitution, which defines and limits both his power and the power of Congress. For law to return to the Supreme Court, what is needed is a philosophical conservatism, espoused particularly these days by Justice Thomas, one which seeks direction for that which has genuine authority, namely the Constitution and the principles animating it. The question of the court's current mode of behavior, its current mode of activism, if you will, I suggest, is even more serious than we have heretofore discussed. For not, the question is not only whether the Supreme Court will continue to enforce social policies which are not of its function. The question is no longer whether the Supreme Court will return to monitoring the powers of the other branches in order to protect the rights of the people. The question is not only whether Congress and the President will continue to accept their roles as mere electors to a third branch of government. The question today is whether the Supreme Court will continue to go beyond law itself. Law itself. Now, what do I mean by going beyond the law? I mean more than just bad law. I mean more than just unauthorized law. I mean non-law. And let me explain. Every system of natural law, whether it be the robust version of Aquinas or the more attenuated version of Locke, holds that there is one obligation of government to its people above all. That is the obligation of protection. Every system of contractarian rights, whether it be the minimalist version of Hobbes or the richer version of Locke, holds that there is one right above all, the right to protection of one's life. Of course, the government cannot guarantee the enjoyment of that right. The police cannot be on every corner. But it must guarantee the possession of that right. The government has the legitimacy of force to try to protect everyone and to punish those who threaten or injure others. The common law gave every man recourse to the king's protection. But when the government gives up the legal right to protect, when the government denies the basic legal rights of individuals to protection from private violence, and when it does so in the form of law, it has gone beyond what law has any legitimacy ever in doing. Whether or not one believes that the child inside the woman is a human individual, there is certainly enough evidence, both in our moral tradition and according to modern science, for a state reasonably to conclude that it is a human individual and to provide it with the basic protection every state has the obligation to provide. But the Supreme Court did not just deny relief for one child that lost its life in an abortion in Roe v. Wade. It disabled the entire government from ever providing that protection. And Casey confirmed that. The unborn child is now literally an outlaw, which in medieval England meant a person who was so dangerous that one could harm him and he was outside the protection of the law. When the Ninth and Second Circuits now give the right of lethal force to a protection and his doctor to end one's own life, those courts disable the state from providing the most basic protection for every individual, the right to be free from harm, even harm of one's own making. The court has entered an area that every modern system of natural law and natural rights has denied it or any government the authority to enter. It has attempted to make legal, which in the very nature of things can never be made legal, and still have a social entity worthy of the name, the rule of law. What the court has done is take positivism, which is will as solely its justification, for force, created a series of private realms of positivistic action for the individual, within which the individual may harm solely on the basis of will, and which the law has no legitimacy in preventing. That is why the next few years' appointments are so critical. There has been much criticism of the kind of judges that have been appointed in recent years. We know currently, for example, the problem of Clinton's appointment of Bud Stack from Florida, a $7 million party hack contributor. Lincoln met that problem. There was one man who was a loyal party worker from Illinois who kept showing up in the White House. You remember he was plagued by these office seekers and demanding a judicial appointment, and Lincoln kept saying, "I'm sorry, there's no vacancy." One morning, the man was walking along the Potomac. This is the story I read. And he saw another man drowned, being pulled out of the Potomac, whom he recognized as a federal judge. He immediately went to the White House, found Lincoln eating breakfast, and said, "Mr. President, I demand that appointment." And the president, without looking up, said, "I'm sorry, the vacancy has been filled. I already appointed the lawyer who saw him fall in." In this criticism, let's keep something clear of the current appointment of justices. We have to recall what a superior job the appointments and selection of the men and women in the Reagan and Bush administrations did. The federal judges appointed during those years were incomparably the best in many generations. The fact that their integrity is not enough to stem the tide lies first of all with nearly the 200 new appointments made by Clinton, the unprincipled leader of the Supreme Court, for which they have to give deference. And I know those in the Republican administrations feel just as betrayed and disappointed as the rest of us with the Supreme Court appointments. But finally, one of the problems why all these great appointments have not been able to stem the tide as much as we had hoped is that the judges are simply not educated. Judges are not educated in the first principles of the law. If they were, they never could have thought they had a right to take away from the state its monopoly of force in the pursuit of safety and hand it over to individuals who may now harm with impunity. So we come down to education. And I think of my own career, and I haven't done a good job. I've taught law, constitutional law, for 20 years. And I spend the first 3 weeks of my constitutional law course, which, as Nino Graglia says, is the Constitution is made by the Supreme Court, which is what we have to teach our students. I spend the first 3 weeks talking about the founding period. I try to summarize the English Whigs. I try to summarize Locke. I try to summarize the common law. I bring out Otis. It goes right over their heads, and because they just don't have any training for it. And then I try to relate it as much as I can as I go through the law of the Supreme Court through the following decades. Now, I'm the only one in my law school who does that out of 43. Most of the judges on the Supreme Court know nothing about the founding. Most of the judges, except Thomas, who's educating himself, most of the judges on the courts know nothing about the founding. That's the problem. We have a group of, frankly, ignorant, not stupid, but ignorant judges. Presuming a Republican administration takes over in 1966, hope beats high, even then, there must be an affirmative program to educate judges, sitting as well as nominees. That, I suggest, is the most imperative obligation of the conservative movement towards the judiciary and restoring the very integrity of the legal system. Thank you.